So would you join me in welcoming Dr. Nick Hamilton?
Well, good evening. It's a pleasure to be here. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. And you know, every time I talk about this, it's hard to, people have asked me before, you know, how long did it take to write the book? What was the process of writing the book? And I'll just say that without telling you some of my life story, it's hard to explain where all of this comes from. So I'm just gonna start there, if you don't mind tonight. As Doug said, we're both from Oregon. I grew up in the only Southern Baptist church for 100 miles in any direction. The northwest corner of Nevada was closer than the next Southern Baptist church from where I grew up. But I left church when I left home and found myself in Arizona as a tune-up mechanic the year that Top Gun came out. And I told my friend, I want to fly airplanes. And he said, well, you know, I think you can fly airplanes or fly helicopters in the Army without a college degree. So I went down to the Army recruiter and I thought, yes, sign me up. I'm ready. I want to, you know, have my hair on fire. And he said, well, I can't help you, but sit down and look at this book of jobs. And some of you are old enough to get this reference. I saw counterintelligence agent in the book of jobs, and I thought, red Ferraris, Hawaii, sign me up. So the Army didn't send me there. I went to Germany, to Munich, and when I turned 21, got my badge as a special agent in Army counterintelligence and did some espionage investigations and was there during the time that the Berlin Wall came down. But that's also when I went back to church. And I went back to International Baptist Church of Munich. And the reality was I had been struggling with a call to ministry for a lot of years, and I ran. And when God called me back, that's where he called me to ministry. And so my pastor began asking me, well, where do you sense that God is leading you in ministry? And I said, I don't know. I just surrendered to ministry. And so in 1989, it was the year that I surrendered to ministry, was the year that the Berlin Wall came down. It was also the year of Tiananmen Square. It was also the year that many men's groups in our church in Munich were sending missionaries into Eastern Europe. And we had a number of refugees from Eastern Europe that were part of our church. And I began to think, God is calling me to Eastern Europe or the former Soviet Union as a missionary. For a lot of different reasons that I won't go into here, that never happened, but I was able to be an exchange student in college in Soviet Central Asia, right after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And so I'm getting to a point here, I promise you. While I was there, I made friends with a guy, you know, had grown up in the atheist environment. And we read Mere Christianity together. We had these long talks about, is there a God? How do you know if there's a God? And he could never get past this idea that there is so much hurt and so much pain in the world that he could never believe that there was a God. And to this day, he's not a believer. And so I would encourage you to pray for him. I won't give you his name in this environment. But this idea of the pain that exists in our world, I think is something that we as Christians need to address and need to address well. I came home from Central Asia. In my last semester at Grand Canyon University, I took a class in Old Testament poetry. As we were going through the book of Job and the book of Psalms, I had this revelation that if only our world understood the wisdom literature of the Bible, if they could only put the problem of pain in the context of the scriptures from the Old Testament, what a difference it would make in our world. And so that's sort of been a lifelong passion. That's where the book came from. That's where my doctoral program was a discipleship of new Christians who've experienced trauma. So I've just always had this passion of talking about trauma and how it impacts a person's relationship with Jesus Christ, or how they decide that they're going to hold God at arm's distance. And so as we get into this tonight, just kind of want to give you a little bit of a roadmap as to where we're going over the course of the next couple of days. Okay, I need to know which of those match with what's behind me.
One on the left.
All right, thank you. There we go. So here's sort of where we're going to be going for this week. We're going to talk tonight about PTSD, moral injury, and sort of the history of all of that, and the way that our world is looking at it now. And I'm going to propose a biblical model for it. Tomorrow morning, we're going to talk about lament and how that has some power for us as we think about how we minister to those who have been through trauma. We'll talk about tomorrow morning as well, God's presence with us through those difficult times. We'll talk about the power of acceptance, or the power of choice, maybe is a better way to say that. And then Wednesday morning, we'll talk about perspective, and we'll get to that. So let's just start tonight with, what are you hearing in the places that you serve these days? I'm sure that you hear a lot about these three things. You hear a lot of people in the corporate world, you hear a lot of people just in the mental health world talking about trauma-informed care, trauma-informed leadership, the idea that we need to be more aware about the traumas that people have been through just in general as we are relating to one another in our daily lives and in leadership. And certainly we need to be aware of this in ministry. But we also hear people throw that word trauma out a lot. We also hear people throw out the idea, well, I have PTSD from. And you fill in the thing that people say that they have PTSD from, and maybe they do and maybe they don't. I don't know whether they meet clinical criteria. We'll talk about that some tonight as well. And so here's a little bit of a roadmap for the night. We'll talk about the definition of trauma. We'll talk about the origins of trauma. We'll talk about sort of the historical perspectives that people have had in how we label, how we think about trauma. We'll talk about some models that are out there about how we look at trauma in our world today and how we think about recovery. And then I've got an idea about a biblical model of trauma. So let's start here. Norm Wright, who's a Christian counselor and has written a lot of stuff, he says this about trauma. He says, trauma is the response to any event that shatters our safe world, so that it makes us feel like it's no longer a safe world. I read a story a few months ago about a nurse in Iraq who was faced with a situation where she had a limited ability in the way that she could treat a particular Marine as this Marine came into the facility in which she was serving as a nurse. And because she couldn't treat him the way that she wanted to be able to treat him, she had this moral dilemma, and the trauma and the pain that was left over from that really became a stumbling block. She became really angry, in fact, about the fact that she could not minister to him and treat his wounds the way that she wanted to, the way that she might be able to in a medical facility in the U.S. Anything that shatters our safe world so that it's no longer a place of refuge. It's more than just a state of crisis. It's that normal reaction to the abnormal events that are around us. That's the way that we should think about how we define trauma in our world. So where did all of this start? I mean, we could go to a lot of different places as we think about where trauma began, but I think as biblical Christians, we need to think about it from this perspective. Right? Go back to the garden. Go back to the beginning. And I want us to think about it in these terms. Think about what the angels were perhaps observing as Eve took that fruit and ate it. and gave some to Adam. And I can only imagine what was going on in heaven in those moments, where perhaps all of the heavenly host were saying, "Did you see what they just did?" And since that moment, our world has been devolving, as you well know. And we add to trauma, lifetime by lifetime, event by event. Everything that happens in our world adds to the level of trauma that we experience on a regular basis. It's cumulative. It builds up. And it's been going on since the beginning of time. It's just part of our world. And I've got news for you tonight. It's not going to end until Jesus comes back. About a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago now, there was a human flourishing conference, webinar for 2 or 3 days. Harvard University is the one that put it on. And there was one presentation in that particular conference, as we were talking about moral injury, where the leader of that session said, you know, we need to find the causes of moral injury so that we can do a better job of eliminating them. Did you hear that? Well, the reality is, if we look at human history, every time we've tried to do that, we've just made it worse. And so we need to start from the perspective that this isn't going to end until Jesus comes back. That needs to be our mindset and our perspective as we think about trauma. And so the way that we have looked at trauma throughout the years, we've labeled it in a lot of different ways. There was a chaplain in our Korea conference that said, you know, there was some folks in the 1600s that labeled trauma or the trauma from war as nostalgia, that longing for it to be the way that it was before we went into these traumatic situations. But during the Civil War, we called this soldier's heart. In World War II, we just said, well, it's shell shock. In World War II, we said, well, it's battle fatigue. And then came the Vietnam War. And we started calling it Vietnam Vet Syndrome. And then finally, when we get to 1980, the American Psychiatric Association, in the third edition of the DSM, categorizes it for the first time as post-traumatic stress disorder. So they finally put a clinical name on this idea of what the Vietnam vets were facing. And just for a minute, I want to take some time, because people do say, you know, I have PTSD because of this, and I think sometimes we minimize this diagnosis of PTSD by doing that. And so I want to take a few minutes, and some of you may already be well aware of what the DSM says about post-traumatic stress disorder, but I want to take a few minutes and go through what the clinical criteria really are for PTSD. First of all, it's the idea that we have to have experienced something that's traumatic. Either we directly saw this, or we witnessed it, we experienced it, we learned about something traumatic happening to a close friend, a close relative, or we experienced that prolonged exposure to trauma. I have a friend, or I worked with a guy, I guess he's a colleague, who for a number of years, or for a deployment, I guess, was the decedent affairs chaplain in Kuwait. And his job for that particular deployment was helping the folks in the morgue zip up all the body bags and write notes home. You think he has PTSD, or do you think he might qualify? He saw all these bodies as a result of his deployment. So you have to have experienced at least one of these things. But it goes further than just experiencing it. You have to have some element of the memory intruding into your life. There has to be some sort of symptom that you're going through in order to really have it categorized as PTSD, whether it's intrusive memories, intrusive dreams, or the like. And then there also has to be some other reactions as well, like flashbacks and prolonged psychological stress or physical reactions to the stress. Maybe backaches, gut aches, whatever the case is that's psychosomatic as a result. And maybe you then also avoid anything that reminds you of that traumatic event, whether it's anything that reminds you of having gone through the event or any reminders of the people, places, or things related to the event. And then there's also a requirement that there has to be a negative impact on the way that your mood a negative mood alteration, I guess, is the best way to say that. You can't remember something. There's beliefs about oneself as a result of the trauma. And maybe you have distorted thoughts as a result of the trauma. I remember coming home from one particular deployment and going into my office one day after lunch and sitting down at the phone to listen to my voicemail messages. I had to listen to the message 5 times before I could concentrate long enough to copy down the phone. That's what this is talking about. There has to be some level of negative cognition, whether it's memory or something else. And then there's a requirement for there to be, sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. There has to be some negative alterations in your arousal activity, whether that is you can't sleep, you are just getting angry and having these outbursts, you're reckless, maybe you go around and lock the doors 5 times before you go to bed at night. Maybe there's an exaggerated startle response. I remember my uncle when he came home from Vietnam talking about hearing a car backfire, and he jumped into a snowbank after he heard that. That's the kind of thing that we're talking about here. And all of these things have to last for longer than a month. And they can't be attributed to anything else. And so I go through all of that clinical material as far as what defines PTSD with a purpose, so that we don't take the diagnosis of PTSD lightly. There are clinical criteria that one has to meet in order to be considered to have PTSD. But as we kind of go back to thinking about how we develop to the point where we are in our thinking about trauma and the way that we think about trauma recovery, I said that PTSD was originally written into the DSM in 1980. Well, along about 1983, there was this guy by the name of Duncan Sinclair that wrote a book called Horrific Traumata. And he started thinking about the idea that maybe this isn't just solely a psychological thing. He started thinking about PTSD more from a spiritual perspective. And I would emphasize the way that he described this was probably using small s, spiritual disorder, not the way that you and I would describe it. And he says that it's a spiritual disorder, not because a person is not right with God or God is not right with the person, but because PTSD takes away from the way that we live our lives. It takes away from the way that we live and have a full and meaningful life. And here's the losses that he describes in his book. He says there's a loss of hope, a loss of intimacy, a loss of the idea that there's a future out there for me, a loss of peacefulness, and you can see the rest of the list there. And so, again, this was like mid-80s that he started talking about the idea that PTSD is more than a psychological condition. There's a spiritual element to it as well. And then there were a group of VA psychiatrists, mostly centered around the Boston area, that started thinking about PTSD as well. And they started saying, you know, as we're treating PTSD, there's an element of this that is just not the psychological piece. There's more to it than just the startle reflexes and some of the avoidance and the things that we talked about earlier. The hardest parts of treating PTSD for them was the idea of trying to treat the moral piece of PTSD. And so they started in the late 90s, early 2000s, talking about this idea of moral injury. And Jonathan Shea has written a couple of different books, but the way that he describes it, and this is the definition of moral injury that I like the best. Jonathan Shea says that moral injury is a betrayal of what's right by someone in authority in a high-stakes situation. There's one Korean War veteran, I'll talk about that story a little bit later, I guess. Brett Litz and his team in 2009 described moral injury this way. He said, it's perpetrating, failing to prevent, bearing witness to, or learning about facts that transgress one's deeply held moral beliefs. So this idea that trauma isn't just a psychological thing. It's a spiritual thing, but it's a moral thing. And then as we think about the symptoms of trauma and PTSD and moral injury, this slide was published in the Huffington Post about 15 years ago. And you can see how PTSD and moral injury share a lot of the same symptoms. Right there in the middle, you see the depression and the anxiety and the insomnia and the nightmares and all of this. And so as we think about all of this, as we think about the background of where we've been and sort of the academic community's thinking about PTSD, moral injury as a whole, I want us to think about, how do we deal with this? What should be the way that we as believers think about, I'm pressing the wrong button. How should we think about dealing with PTSD and moral injury? What are some ways that people are thinking about it out there now? And I want you to take maybe just 2 minutes. 2 minutes. I know you're Baptists. I know you're chaplains. I know you like to talk. 2 minutes, okay? At your tables. And I want you to think together for just 2 minutes about these questions. What should be our goal in trauma ministry? Can you repair a person's soul? Excuse me, after they've been through something like this. What's the role in grief ministry? And what does this concept of homeostasis mean in terms of trauma ministry? And what is the role of lament? Okay, 2 minutes, go.